I would characterize it as early to mid-stage exploration, meaning they're concentrating on core drilling.
Exploring for the country's first graphite mine near Nome. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, one Alaskan tries to cancel her healthcare.gov insurance policy and finds it's not so easy.
I don't even know how to feel about the whole thing anymore because I can't even get anybody who has an answer to help. It's just such a lost cause at this point.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
A small Canadian mining company is in the exploratory phases of setting up a graphite mine on the Seward Peninsula. Though years away from being operational, the Graphite Creek deposit could be the nation's first and only graphite mine. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
According to Jack DeMarkey from the Department of Natural Resources, the company, Graphite One, is just beginning to explore resource deposits 40 miles north of Nome.
I would characterize it as early to mid-stage exploration, meaning they're concentrating on core drilling. So I think they'll continue to do that for a couple of more years, and then they will very quickly start using that information to start coming up kind of with a conceptual plan for how they might mine it.
Graphite One has a memorandum of understanding with DNR at this point, part of the permitting process for developing hard rock mines in the state. DeMarkey says there's still a lot of baseline environmental data to gather before any further steps in the development process can be taken.
They're probably going to start doing some of the environmental work that most projects start doing at about this stage, and that's so they typically need to collect data in the field during the summer months and some of it during the winter months. But this information would be used both for permitting and to some degree would also be used to in their future engineering studies when they start.
Currently, there aren't any graphite mines in the U.S. The mineral is vital to a number of industrial processes and products, everything from vehicle frames to batteries, as well as pencils. According to DeMarkey, the mining process of graphite is relatively straightforward compared to extracting other hard metals.
My understanding of it is that it's a pretty simple process. I think when they say it's more like a gravel quarry, it's excavating fairly benign rock and placing it in a pile, the waste rock pile, without having to manage it especially carefully because it's lacking any of the kinds of metals that we want to protect from the environment from.
The existing claim is on a mix of federal and state lands just below the Imarok Basin and a few miles from the Taylor Highway. At present, there's no development in the area, and it's been noted for the degree to which the surrounding wilderness is still intact. The site, which the company calls Graphite Creek, is still at least 3 to 5 years from having an operational mine on it, and while the limited amount of information that's come out so far is optimistic, DeMarkey says almost everything is preliminary at this point.
We haven't seen any detailed information from the company yet, so we just don't have any information that we can hang our hat on.
Graphite One's president, Anthony Houston, responded to phone and email inquiries that because of travel, he wasn't available to discuss the project until December. In Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The National Science Foundation's new Arctic research vessel, Sikuliak, will spend the winter undergoing trials in the Great Lakes. The 261-foot-long ship to be operated by the University of Alaska Fairbanks was launched in Lake Michigan a year ago. But as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the Sikuliak's original target date for arrival at home port in Seward has been delayed a year due to technical problems.
The Sikuliak might not show up in Seward until early 2015, as the vessel must undergo a list of fixes and trials before it can even depart the Great Lakes and head for Alaska. Project Principal Investigator Terry Whitledge points to tests conducted earlier this month in Lake Michigan that turned up numerous problems with the new ship.
There's about 800 things that we picked up on this trial. And it runs the gamut from the HVAC systems, which is the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems, to various pumps and the interfaces to the navigation system, and kind of almost everything you can think of. It's a pretty complex machine altogether, and almost all the systems need a little tweaking somewhere.
Whitledge says overall cost of the project is still well within its $200 million budget, and the delay is not a surprise given the complexity of the one-of-a-kind research ship.
There's approximately 97 miles of wiring within the ship and thousands of connections, and all those have to be checked out. And historically, when a new ship comes online, it's quite common to have issues pop up for the first few months.
Whitledge says it hasn't been determined whether the Sikuliak will travel to Alaska via the Panama Canal or through the Northwest Passage. He says the decision will likely hinge on the location of contract research projects and how they dovetail with the ship's transit. University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences Dean Mike Castellini says the Sikuliak's first research season is still on schedule.
If everything works the way it should, the science begins when it was supposed to have begun anyway, which would be in the late summer of 14. So we built in enough time on the far side so that while it changes the internal schedule of when the trials were done and where, it has almost zero impact on the actual schedule for the science of the ship.
The Sikuliak's first scientific project will happen in the Great Lakes as it undergoes trials this winter. The National Science Foundation plans to use the ship as a platform to test a newly outfitted remote underwater vehicle for the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A state and federally funded task force has investigated biomass energy potential in 75 communities around the state. Alaska Energy Authority biomass manager Devaney Plentovich is tracking projects that have resulted from a baseline analysis that looked at availability of wood and opportunity for turning it into energy.
From those 75 pre-feasibility studies, we've got about 20 systems that are operational within the state, some large, some very small. We've got about 11 systems that are in construction and another 5 or 6 that are in the design phase, and that's with state funding through the Renewable Energy Fund.
Project locations range from Prince of Wales Island in southeast to the Kobuk River Valley in northwest Alaska. Among biomass projects in the design phase is a wood chip-fueled system in Fort Yukon.
It's going to heat a number of buildings within the community. It's also going to be paired with the diesel generation system and the heat recovery system. So there'll be heat from the generators and heat from biomass heating a number of buildings within the community.
The Denali Commission has provided funding for purchase of wood harvest equipment, including cutting, hauling, and chipping machines. Plentovich says it's all arrived on site in Fort Yukon this fall.
And they are beginning to do operator training and doing initial wood harvest. That way they can harvest wood, let it season for a year or two, so it's going to be ready when the biomass system is operational.
The $6 to $7 million project includes the new harvest and processing equipment, as well as the biomass boiler, new power plant, and heat recovery equipment. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, saving the Front Street Clinic that serves the homeless in Juneau.
If the Front Street Clinic disappeared, this huge gap would appear that nobody could fill.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com.
Health Insurance Primera Alaska will allow 5,200 customers in the state to keep their insurance plans. The company canceled the plans for 2014 because they didn't meet requirements of the Affordable Care Act. But earlier this month, after public outcry, President Obama said insurers could offer those canceled plans for another year as long as states allowed it. Primera spokesperson Melanie Kuhn says customers will have to extend their plans by December 31st.
We're planning to offer extensions to our members in Alaska, and right now we're still finalizing the details with the Department or the Division of Insurance. So we still have some details to work out, but we do plan on offering those extensions to our members.
Primera says it will have more details on the insurance plan extension soon, including whether rates will increase as they normally would each year. Customers will also have the option of buying new coverage on the healthcare.gov marketplace. That's the only way to qualify for subsidies to help pay for insurance. Enroll Alaska reports the healthcare.gov website is slowly improving. The insurance brokerage has enrolled 78 Alaskans on the marketplace so far. Chief Operating Officer Tyann Bowling says on a scale of 1 to 10, the website is functioning at about a 4.
Any type of complexity, the system does not function well at all with. And the challenge is that Americans' lives are complex.
Anchorage hairstylist Laura Emler is one of the few Alaskans who managed to get through the healthcare.gov process late last month. Now, though, after she discovered problems with her application, Emler wants to cancel her enrollment, and she's finding that may be difficult, APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Earlier this month, Laura Emler sounded thrilled to finally be enrolled in an affordable insurance plan. Now she sounds more like this.
I don't even know how to feel about the whole thing anymore because I can't even get anybody who has an answer to help. It's just such a lost cause at this point.
A few things went wrong with Laura Emler's healthcare.gov application. First, according to the website, she enrolled in a health plan, but her new insurance company, Moda Health, didn't have her application. When she called the healthcare.gov hotline number, no one could help her figure out what went wrong. Then she found out the website miscalculated her subsidy amount. She was supposed to receive a monthly subsidy of $366, but the website only let her use $315.
The subsidy issue is weird. If you look at my profile on the website, it shows my full subsidy, but it says that I'm only using part of it. So they know I've got a screwed up subsidy, but they don't know what to do with it. There's no one directly you can call and talk to say, hey, my subsidy's on there. How do I apply all of that?
Getting the subsidy corrected would require filing a paper appeal with the federal government. So the technical problems with Emler's enrollment were adding up. At the same time, she started hearing stories from friends whose insurance plans were being canceled because they didn't meet the Affordable Care Act requirements. Emler says some of those friends don't qualify for subsidies and aren't able to find affordable new insurance.
I have a moral dilemma with that why should I be able to get health insurance when other people are having to lose it?
Emler needed a break from healthcare.gov. So on a recent morning, she sat on her living room couch with a cup of coffee and her laptop.
I've had to change my password about 4 times. Oh, you know what? I have it written down. I cheated. There it is.
The site actually logs Emler in pretty quickly. And after a few clicks, she finds her enrollment information.
This is my application that I applied on the 24th of October.
And it says status complete.
Yeah, it says complete. So you have to click on here. On the actual application.
Emler scrolls down and eventually sees an ominous-looking red icon that says Terminate Coverage.
So you hit the Terminate button. It says you've chosen to end the following coverage. You then have to check, I have fully read and understand that I'm choosing to terminate coverage. And then you click the Terminate again, and we'll see what happens.
What happens is nothing. The health plan Emler signed up for is still listed in her profile. She logs out and then back in, and it looks exactly the same. She checks her email for a notice of coverage termination and finds nothing there either. Emler leans back on the couch and looks surprisingly calm about the whole thing.
I'm resigned to the fact that it doesn't work. No matter what I do, it just doesn't work. And this is the improved website.
When she is able to cancel her plan, Emler won't be quitting healthcare.gov for good. She's been uninsured for nearly a decade and wants that to change. She plans to log back into the website early next year to start the process all over again. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, decided to cut funding to Juneau's homeless medical clinic at the end of September due to budgetary constraints. Front Street Clinic got a 6-month reprieve when the community was able to raise more than $120,000. Now a coalition of local organizations have joined together to keep the clinic open, hopefully forever. KTOO's Lisa Fu reports.
Front Street Clinic is in the process of becoming its own nonprofit organization with a new name, Front Street Health Center. it will still offer the same services, medical, dental, and behavioral health, and it'll be run by a board of directors from agencies involved in the care of the homeless population.
I think that all of his agencies just realized that if a Front Street Clinic disappeared, this huge gap would appear that nobody could fill.
Maria Lovashuk is executive director of The Glory Hole, Juneau's soup kitchen and shelter. She's also the president of the newly formed Front Street Health Center board. Other members come from AWARE, Bartlett Regional Hospital, Catholic Community Services, Juneau Alliance for Mental Health, and St. Vincent de Paul. The board also includes a physician, a public health nurse, and an accountant.
Because so many entities are coming together, the clinic will be able to function really affordably in a really sensible manner because the burden is now shared across so many caring and competent organizations.
Board members are providing resources and services to help run Front Street. For example, Catholic Community Services will take care of Medicaid and Medicare billing, REACH is in charge of janitorial services, and an accountant for LG Rayfield Mertz will do Front Street taxes.
I just feel so grateful to live in a community that has so many dedicated and caring individuals and organizations coming together to ensure that people have access to the very, very basic thing, which is primary medical care.
Board Vice President Dr. Carlton Hine was one of several emergency room doctors who donated money when Front Street was in danger of shutting down in October. He says they recognize that if the clinic closed, most of its patients would end up in the ER.
We're very good at heart attacks and broken bones and lacerations. We're not very good at chronically managing diabetes or hypertension or chronic heart disease. We're good at acute care, not at chronic ongoing primary care. And the Front Street Clinic does a much better job of providing that kind of service for these patients.
Bartlett Regional Hospital will provide laboratory and imaging services for Front Street. If a patient needs an x-ray or blood test, instead of being sent to search, the patient will go to Bartlett.
Paying a little bit for these appropriate tests ordered through a primary care doctor is certainly a less expensive route for the hospital than having these patients become much sicker. Patients in the emergency department with those tests being done through the emergency department and then potentially sick enough to be admitted to the hospital because they haven't had the appropriate primary care.
The plan is for Front Street Clinic to become Front Street Health Center when Search gives up management. Dan Neumeister is Chief Financial Officer.
Currently, Search is operating the clinic through the end of April, and we are working very closely with the Homeless Coalition in Juneau to make, if at all possible, a seamless transition.
Partial funding for Front Street Clinic comes from a $160,000 grant from the U.S. Health Resources and Services Administration, which ends April 30th. The new Front Street Health Center board hopes to secure the same federal grant, as well as pursue other funding sources. Search operated Front Street at around $600,000 a year. Lovashuk says the anticipated budget under the new board is 30% lower. Another difference is that more people will be able to access services. Front Street Health Center will still cater to the homeless, but will also be available to low-income people and others in need of medical care. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the historic Anchorage Hotel, offering accommodations for up to 150 guests for business meetings or social event occasions. A boutique hotel in the heart of downtown, historicanchoragehotel.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Matsu Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
New court documents have been filed in Alaska's Court of Appeals arguing why the convictions of about a dozen Yupik subsistence fishermen should be overturned. The fishermen are fighting for religious rights to fish for king salmon. From KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes has more.
The case goes back to June of 2012, when the Kuskokwim River was closed to king salmon fishing for 12 days, longer than ever before. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game called the closure to get more kings to the spawning grounds because the runs had diminished in recent years. Fishermen and their families were anxious to get fish hung up and smoked while the dry weather lasted. Some villages organized a kind of fishing protest where dozens of fishermen threw their nets in the river anyway. State and federal managers responded by citing about 36 people in one day. The fishermen were found guilty and fined in the Bethel District Court, and now about a dozen of them are taking the case through the appeals process. James Davis Jr. is their lawyer.
Subsistence is so essential to Yupik people and the way they see themselves in the world and their sense of how the universe operates, that it needs to be protected just as if it were a more orthodox religion like Catholicism or Judaism.
The trial court found that the fishermen had a spiritual connection to king salmon, and fishing for them was a religious practice. But the state's obligation to protect the run supersedes that. Three groups have filed Friends of the Court briefs supporting the fishermen in the appeals court: the Alaska Civil Liberties Union, the Association of Village Council Presidents, and the Alaska Federation of Natives. Sky Starkey is an attorney representing AFN and AVCP. He says their brief has two points. The first supports the lower court ruling that subsistence fishing is a religious practice.
The second part of the amici brief focuses in on the actions that the state could have taken that would have allowed some fishing for this, to accommodate this spiritual and religious aspect of fishing, while also preserving the Chinook runs on the Kuskokwim.
That could have included restricting the pollock fleet or other non-Yupik fishermen on the river. The state still has to file its appeals brief, responding to the fishermen's. A request for an extension was filed, meaning it won't be turned in until January 4th. Assistant Attorney General Laura Fox says the state will argue that the Court of Appeals should uphold the convictions. She says the Fish and Game Department tries its best to manage and protect the salmon runs, which is not an easy task.
Sometimes the Department of Fish and Game has to restrict fishing to make sure enough king salmon can make it up the river to spawn. And it's important that the state be able to enforce its fishing restrictions to protect the sustainability of the king salmon run for future generations.
The whole appeals process will likely take months, including more briefs being filed, oral arguments, and then eventually the court's decision. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
A group of Juneau residents are tackling the issue of racism head-on. Their work started earlier this year and sprang out of the trial of George Zimmerman for killing unarmed Florida teenager Trayvon Martin, as well as a series of local events that had been building up for years. They held a panel discussion earlier this month at the University of Southeast Alaska. KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
Act 1. If racism was a burning kitchen, an Asian and a Caucasian are standing in a kitchen, the kitchen is on fire.
UAS professor Saul Neely sets the scene for a short skit by local writer Christy Name Erickson, performed by Lance Twitchell and M.K. McNaughton.
Whoa! Is the kitchen on fire?
Are you calling me an arsonist? I'm not an arsonist.
I am literally burning up. I'm pretty sure the kitchen is on fire.
I didn't build this house. I just live here.
Let's leave and build a new house.
I'm not going anywhere. This is my house.
That scene and three others were part of the panel discussion Deconstructing Racism, Power and Privilege in Our Community. Twitchell is a Tlingit speaker and a professor of Alaska Native Languages at UAS. McNaughton is an artist and social justice activist. They were joined by Neely, Alaska Native storyteller Ishmael Hope, and Northern Light United Church pastor Phil Campbell. Twitchell acknowledged many people prefer to avoid talking about race and racism. He said the panel's discussion was not the beginning of the conversation, nor should it be the end.
It's important that this conversation occurs throughout our community on a regular basis so that we can become more aware of the types of things that create oppression.
Like the Asian character in Erickson's play suggesting they leave the burning house and build a new one, the panelists suggested tearing down social systems that create racism. Hope said too often people of color are marginalized.
And in fact often get thrown into jail, targeted, not supported for success, put in the area where they're denied access to success and to power and to, you know, to privilege and any kind of authority.
He pointed to the Alaska Native dropout rate, which is often cited as an example of inherent racism in the education system. According to the National Indian Education Association, Alaska is one of 14 states where the Native American graduation rate is lower than 60%.
There's something wrong there.
The panelists said an incident last April during the Alaska Folk Festival sparked them to begin talking about racism locally. A group of revelers at the annual Bourbon Brunch, which is not officially part of Folk Festival, dressed up in Asian-themed garb. Pictures of the event were posted on social media, leading to questions about whether it was racist. McNaughton says she found the photos mildly to wildly offensive.
Mostly focused on really sexually demeaning stereotypical female images of Asian women.
She decided to speak out after playwright Erickson was attacked on Facebook for pointing out how the party was offensive. McNaughton said it can be difficult for white people to admit that something they have done is racist or to speak out when they witness racism taking place.
And I don't mean to pick on other white people. I have said racist things naively. I haven't spoken up every time I've heard or seen something racist. Sometimes people take your breath away. Sometimes you just don't have the words or know how to respond in the moment.
The Reverend Phil Campbell has taught social justice classes at universities and theology schools. He says white people have work to do when it comes to talking about race.
We're not very skilled at understanding ourselves as raced, and therefore racism is someone else's problem that we might help with, when, in fact, I would posit it is primarily in this society a white problem.
Toward the end of the discussion, an audience member asked the panelists if they were optimistic about the future. Twitchell said he was cautiously optimistic, noting that Alaska Natives still have higher suicide rates and higher rates of being victims of violent crime than other races.
But I am optimistic because we can have these conversations and they occur on a larger level.
Saul Neely responded to the question by quoting African-American philosopher and activist Cornel West, who said, "I cannot be an optimist, but I am a prisoner of hope." In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lisa Fu and Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by Alex Hotel and Suites, featuring amenities that include a 24-hour airport shuttle, hot continental breakfast, and a walk-in freezer. Information on Alaska resident rates at 1-800-221-7550. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.